listen-only mode.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. And thank you for being here for another virtual Board of Public Works meeting. This, I believe, is this the third time that we've done this virtually? I'm losing track. It's also being live streamed, as all BPW meetings are, back in terms of the live streaming. I do want to take a quick moment and just, you know, talk about the fact that the last time we had a BPW meeting, we had 727 viewers during the course of the meeting, which is a significant jump from what we normally average, about 100 viewers. So this is, I guess, with stay-at-home orders, this is now becoming number two to Netflix and some of the shows that are on there, or at least the political and those people who like to follow good government. So, you know, because we can't physically all be together in the State House, we're doing this virtually, and I guess more people are interested in what's going on. I do want to just give a brief update on where we are with the coronavirus and our response to it. I know the governor's going to have a press conference a little later today, talk in more detail, but the Department of Health just announced this morning that we now have 28,163 confirmed cases of coronavirus in our state. That is an increase of 1,046 over yesterday, which to some extent is not very surprising as we've been increasing the amount of people getting tested. We still are running a little less than 20% of the people tested are testing positive. So we knew that that was going to happen. The key numbers, though, that we've been looking at recently have been, of course, the fatalities as well as hospitalizations. And we feel that our efforts with regard to mitigation, and I say our, but I mean the kind of the royal power, from the state, but then the compliance of our citizens has allowed us to not only limit the amount of the spread, but more so to make sure that our hospitals and healthcare system is not overwhelmed, as we saw in Italy and to a certain extent New York City. So our hospitalizations as well as fatalities, I think, are the key measures that we are really looking at. And our hospitalizations have been relatively steady. The currently those who are in hospitals is at 1,707. That's a slight increase from yesterday. I think an increase of about 15 individuals. More importantly, our ICU patients is flat and has been so for the last 6 days or so. So that is something that we are happy about, because those are the people, of course, they're in critical care. Statewide fatalities.
Governor, do you have a number on that, the ICU?
ICU beds are 584. And yesterday it was 573, so it went up 11.
35-40% of those in hospitals. Most of the ones in hospitals are not in ICU.
Yes, yes. And actually, like I said, 20% of less than 20% of those who've been hospitalized generally, or I should say, less than 20% of all of our confirmed cases have gone sometime into a hospital. So 80% of our confirmed cases have been recovering at home. Fatalities have reached 1,338. Which is a slight decrease from yesterday, and it's increased today of 48, unfortunately, people lost their lives to this virus. So last week, the governor did introduce Maryland's Strong Roadmap to Recovery, looking at a responsible, gradual, and safe path forward for our state. Now, based on the understanding of what a recovery would look like while protecting our health at the same time, and that those goals are not opposed to one another. So we'll continue to address the health emergency from all angles. And as I mentioned, the governor will talk more about it this afternoon in his press conference with regard to our challenge and how we continue to work to mitigate, to save lives, as well as try to get back to some normalcy, whatever that's going to be. So with that, Madam Treasurer, I'll turn it over to you for some opening remarks.
Thank you. Governor, you've given us a lot of the information that we were seeking. I do want to say that I've received recently, and I mentioned this 2 weeks ago also, communications from our state employees who were very concerned about what is happening, what happens to them, especially those who were in correctional institutions, group homes, hospitals, to make sure that they have the proper protective equipment and they know that they are frontline, of course. They know that whether it's a Spring Grove or one of the other institutions, both patients and state employees have tested positive. In fact, over 70% of the correctional officers in some of the institutions who are still there, who are still working, who have to go home to their families, and are concerned and are surrounded by the virus. And I would ask that you all make a particular effort to not only provide all the equipment that's needed, the testing and the health care that's needed for our state employees, but make it clear to the state employees that you are doing that, both at the state's own institutions as well as at the nursing homes around the state, because they're frightened, and they are right to be frightened. And it looks as though perhaps the curve is bending correctly, or at least is steady, but we're responsible for those folks, and I feel very strongly they not only take care of them, provide for them as any good employer would, but let them know what we are doing. So I ask that of you, Governor.
Thank you. No, that's a very good point, and yeah, we do understand their concern, and you know, we appreciate their work, but you're right, they go back to their family. You know, the unfortunate thing is that both with the nursing homes as well as our hospitals and correctional facilities, it's been the staff that has brought it in because they're in the outside world.
They go out and come in and go out again.
And they don't know that they may not be showing symptoms, or they have very mild symptoms and didn't think of anything, particularly early on, and because we did limit and eliminate visitors to both nursing homes as well as the correctional institutions early on and instituted more phone time and video conferencing so that they could still talk to the those who were patients or inmates could still talk to their families, but the virus got into the facilities. And so it comes from the outside. So, yes, it's very important that we protect employees.
One of the things that's frightening to people is not knowing what's going on around, which is why I stress the importance of the communications, to say, as you did for us just now, here are the cases, here's what we're doing about it, here's the sort of equipment you need, here's when you're going to have the equipment, here's what's going to happen if you become ill or if somebody you're working with becomes ill. So everyone knows what to expect. And that takes a lot of effort, a lot of work.
Well, I know Secretary Green is providing a lot of information to his people in public safety and corrections. And, you know, I guess it's never too much or too often. So we probably more, you know, need to be more repetitive in terms of providing information to our employees and making sure that they.
I do think it would be helpful.
Well, thank you, Madam Treasurer.
Are we going to have some sort of presentation? I hope we will, either today or at the next meeting about all the procurements dealing with COVID, not just the sensational ones that may be really questionable. Yeah,
my understanding is that we'll be bringing the emergency procurements next week or the next 2 weeks from now.
That they'll and most of them are emergency.
I'm sorry, I spoke over.
Most of the procurements are emergencies?
I don't know if all of them are or not. I'll have to double check. I know the emergency procurements will be brought next week. Some may be, you know, under existing contracts, but those that are emergencies will be brought next week.
Good. Thank you.
Mr. Cottrell.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and I want to associate myself with both the Treasurer and the Lieutenant Governor, and I'm delighted to be on the Board of Public Works today with each of you. I think the Hogan administration should be commended for its clear communications. I agree with the Treasurer that that's a top priority, and I think that whether you're a Republican or Democrat, you have to admit that we're getting information from Governor Hogan that seems to be not sugar-coated and made-up stuff, but in fact is exactly what's going on. So, Boyd, please give my regards to the Governor and Madam Treasurer. I couldn't agree with you more about the need for constant updating and communication. That's what we need. And we'll all get through this. This is was supposed to be National Small Business Week. Boyd, you and I would have been out in the past visiting small businesses all across the state to recognize and celebrate what everybody concedes is their immeasurable contribution to the state's economy. We're talking about 175,000 small businesses. I think 40,000 of those are sole proprietorships, so it's not as if they're those are particularly noticeable, but the other 130,000 are definitely front and center as far as the health of the state's economy. Many of their futures right now are uncertain, and the livelihoods have been jeopardized, as we all know. We're estimating there could be 20, 30, 40,000 small businesses that do not reemerge from this current pandemic. It's unprecedented. I wrote, and I think I mentioned it in the last Board of Public Works, a letter to the Federal Small Business Administration urging them to administer the Payroll Protection Program funds in a way that it was intended to be utilized, and that was to help small businesses and not multi-million dollar publicly traded companies that have all sorts of reserves and investors backing them up. This was money that was directed at the small businesses all like I mentioned in the state of Maryland that make up the backbone of our state's economy. I did not get a response from the small business administrator, not that I was expecting one, but I certainly hope she got the message. I'm confident that our congressional delegation and will hold the Trump administration accountable and ensure that our small businesses are getting the federal assistance that they expect and deserve. I know that the Department of Commerce here in Maryland, led very ably by Secretary Schultz, is working diligently to get these commerce grants out, and my office, of course, stands ready to process these payments expeditiously wherever and whenever they are authorized. In the meantime, I would urge all Marylanders to help Maryland small businesses through a program called #Bar Keep the Lights On, that we initiated here in the Comptroller's office. Especially during Small Business Week, I encourage Marylanders to support their local businesses by ordering a meal from their favorite local restaurant, shopping at a local grocery store, or frankly, since I'm its chief alcohol regulator, ordering some brews from the over 100 Maryland breweries across the state. And if you can post a picture of your supporting a local restaurant with the hashtag #Hashtag Keep the Lights On, we'll mail you one of those bumper stickers, which were not printed at government expense, as a gesture of my personal appreciation. And I also encourage people that may not be in the takeout, order out, carry, whatever it is, curbside delivery stuff. If you just have some extra resources and wanted to buy some gift certificates from your local small businesses, do that, I would certainly, you know, as a personal, personally would like to appreciate and suggest that people do that. Down the road, obviously those gift cards can be used, but right now those small businesses need the money. I'd also like to just urge that everybody continue to listen to the governor, lieutenant governor, and our other health experts. I know there's a lot of pressure to let the steam out and open up the golf courses and the boating and the restaurants and this and that, but it has to be done carefully. Otherwise, we're going to risk a second shutdown if we don't do this right. And Lieutenant Governor, I know you guys are looking very closely at it. If I could also just commemorate that today is National Nurses Day. It is impossible to overstate the tremendous sacrifice and valor of the 80,000 nurses in the state of Maryland. As the treasurer mentioned, many of these folks are on the front lines. They're working every day to save the lives of Marylanders. Many of them are putting themselves in individual jeopardy. A recent survey found that 74% of Maryland nurses are concerned about access to personal protection gear. Only 20% indicated their facility had adequate supply of COVID test kits. 86% of 80,000 nurses are urging the public to follow the social distancing guidelines. So, channeling Florence Nightingale, who created this wonderful sector, and now it's filled with people with great talent and great bravery. I just wanted to give them a tip of the hat on National Nurses Day. We're grateful to each of you for what you do every day, and we especially honor your work and your commitment. Thank you, Madam Treasurer and Lieutenant Governor.
Happy Nurses Day. Yep.
You know, Governor, that as the comptroller knows, Clara Barton's house actually is in Maryland at Glen Echo in District 16, and unfortunately, people visit right now, but. Welcome to there. The comptroller touched on something else. I wonder if when we have our report, and maybe the governor will say it this morning, the whole question of the tests. It was great that he got all those tests from South Korea, hats off. Where we are in administering them and obtaining all the other things you have to put together with the test before you can actually use them. And then I also had a question. After we do the test, of course, everyone knows that what you have to do is the tracking.
Contact tracking.
How we're going about getting a cadre of people, I think it'll be very difficult to do that.
Yes, I know that we've been hiring people to do the contact tracing. We are utilizing a service that is helping us find people to do that. I don't think we've completely ramped up to the numbers that we are hitting our objective in terms of that number, but I think we can get that information. At least by the next meeting, I should get a report on that. I'll make sure. If the governor doesn't announce anything today, on that.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Secretary, Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 10 items on the Secretary's agenda and one report of emergency procurement. Items 7 and 8 have been revised. Madam Treasurer, I know that we have Department of General Services Deputy Secretary Reichert. The state's procurement advisor, Dave Nall, the chief procurement officer, Bob Gleason, and others available for any questions about the emergency procurement process.
That would come up then under the DGS agenda. That would be the appropriate time to raise.
Okay.
It's up to you, Madam Treasurer.
Kind of following the comptroller's small business week statement and proclamation, unofficial proclamation, item 3 Neighborhood Business Development Program. I don't have a question on this, but the market 818 or 818 market, I had an opportunity to visit that facility when I was doing a Catonsville tour, and they were still building it and talking to the owner and what they're planning to do there. And right there on Frederick Road, it's really a bustling area in Catonsville, one of our Main Street type of locations. It's really going to be something that's wonderful. I'm glad that we can support this. There's a lot of activity that's taking place there. And it happened to be on the same day that I believe we reported our first cases in Maryland, because I was touring there and had to go back to the State House as we were announcing that we had just gotten word of our first three cases of COVID. So I just wanted to point that out, that supporting the small business and the activities that are taking place there on Frederick Road in Catonsville.
Excellent. I had a similar recognition on item 7, Lieutenant Governor, which is the a contract for dining services at Morgan State University.
Yes.
One of our gems of an institution in the state of Maryland, the higher ed institution. Back in 2000. Unfortunately, it was a single bid procurement involving the dining services contract, and I think the treasurer and I expressed some concerns about the fact that that was not the kind of competitive procurement that we would like to see, because, if you have competitive bids, then you actually have proof from the marketplace that you're getting the lowest possible bid with the highest possible value to it. So in this procurement, which is the same issue that we were concerned about 6 years ago, now that we have the renewal coming up, and I'm happy to see there were actually four very competitive bids. Sodexo Magic, which I believe is based in Maryland, is being recommended for the award. I wanted to commend Morgan State for not just doing the same old, but quite frankly, correcting that kind of lack of competition. And I believe that that will benefit the taxpayers and maintain faith and integrity in government when they look at a procurement like this, because it's so honest and fair and transparent.
Well, I think the comptroller is right. I recall the prior episode. But my understanding also is that this whole offering is a new updated dining arrangement for the students that is the result of actually consulting with students and finding out what people really want to eat and the sort of services they need. So it's not only well done, but it sounds like it's a modern, up-to-date, and good product. That's
Yeah. We do have President Wilson available to join for any questions or observations about the item.
All right. Love to say hi to the president.
Okay.
Yeah, Dr. Wilson, turn on your camera.
Okay, if you can turn your camera on.
Yeah, there it is. There it is.
I didn't know you were on, but
very far away.
Yeah, you were closer in the earlier.
In
the at the United Nations or something.
I think get us closer in a little bit.
Oh, you're zooming in now.
Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
From
FTC.
Anyway, President Wilson, let me congratulate Morgan State, and under your leadership, these are exactly the kind of competitive responses, and I know it's not easy to get that all the time, but hats off to your team for producing something that's very defensible.
Thank you very much, Mr. Comptroller, and let me express my appreciation to members of the Board of Public Works. We are very appreciative, of course, for the overall support that we have received from the state of Maryland in Morgan State University, and I want to thank Governor Hogan, and his administration for the increase that he put in our operating budget this past year. It was the largest single year increase in our operating budget in our history. And so while we certainly understand the economic conditions that the state is under now, we are optimistic here at Morgan that we will land in a very positive place on the other side of COVID-19 and that the type of commitment will continue on the part of the state. And I have been listening in as well, and I certainly join on behalf of our Board of Regents here at Morgan in expressing our appreciation to the leadership of the governor for leading us through this crisis in the way that he has handled it. That was made known yesterday during the meeting of the Board of Regents, and I'm speaking in turn and expressing. Madam Treasurer, you had it right that in this procurement, we learned our lesson, and we learned our lesson in the right way. And we wanted to hear from our students. And we received over a 50% response rate from our students, which was unheard of. So Morgan, with a student population of nearly 8,000.
Doctor, your audio has gone out. I apologize.
The visual.
Yes.
Who could assist with restoring Dr. Wilson's audio, please?
Okay.
Yeah, we're not hearing you.
I'm sure it was very eloquent.
Yes.
Maybe, John, we could pick that up later, maybe.
Or maybe one of
them. Yeah.
It is a great
project. I think we got the gist of it, and...
Don't worry, Dr. Wilson. Last week, my audio wasn't working, so...
I trust the president was about to cite the strong role of the Maryland General Assembly, the Speaker of the House, in obtaining the support for Morgan State University as well. I think that's what he's trying to say.
Yes. Maybe we should move on.
We have received one request for public comment on this item. If the board would like to hear from Mr. Patrick Moran from AFSCME.
Sure. Yes. Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, and Governor. Thank you for allowing me to comment on this issue. First and foremost, we obviously, as a public employee union, are opposed to privatization, but we're happy to see that Morgan took the guidance from the Board of Public Works in the face of the last procurement and had a competitive bid at this point. We are just very concerned, and we hope that the board will push the university to ensure that these employees that are now going to be providing the goods and services to the students, most importantly, and also to our members and employees that work there at the university, they be given the same protective equipment that other people in similar situations have. I mean, it would be a shame to see those folks serving the students without the necessary health and safety measures that unfortunately we're just not seeing in the state right now, whether that's in the state hospitals or the juvenile facilities where there's little or no public protective equipment or no testing, as we all know, going on, which is one of the indicators of how we stop this virus. So we're hoping that Morgan can make sure that in this agreement there is the necessary personal protective equipment and testing if needed to ensure the safety and the health of the students and the other Morgan employees on campus. So they're not in the same situation as public employees or the state employees such as the prisons, where 70% of those that are carrying the virus in the prisons are actually officers themselves. It's very disheartening to see this, and it's blown up with over 300 cases among state employees, and we don't want to see that happen at Morgan. Thank you.
Thank you. I I just want to make a couple more comments, and then I have a question.
Governor, could I just ask, following on that, if John, maybe the Secretary, could follow up with the President and make sure that that his concerns are, in fact, answered and that we get the response?
Yes, Madam Treasurer, I absolutely will. And the President, if the university's audio is working again, does have the opportunity to unmute themselves and turn their camera back on. But I certainly will pass that along if they're unable to do so.
Thanks. I'm sorry, Governor.
That's all right. I'm just going to mention item number 4, which is broadband, emergency broadband education assistance grants to a number of libraries throughout the state, Calvert Library, Charles County's Library, Harford County Library, and Queen Anne's and Worcester County libraries that are getting these grants to expand their broadband service and access for individuals. And that's something that, you know, we've been working very hard at over the last several years, dating back to the first term, to expand broadband access, particularly in number 10.
Governor, could I just ask you, I'm not sure who actually, but the background for this item, as you mentioned, was COVID-19 and the fact that students have to use the broadband and that it's being made available at these libraries. Was there any look, or could we find out, there was any thought of using COVID-19 funds for that instead of just the regular capital funds?
Senator, we do have Secretary Holt, who is available to join us to discuss this item.
It's a great project. I certainly wouldn't want to. But
good morning.
Morning, Secretary.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer. Thank you for the question. Mr. Comptroller, Lieutenant Governor, it's great to see you. I'd like to first thank John Gontram and James Pontedure for setting all this up. You've done a great job. I know you put a lot of work into it, and it's an effective way to communicate. Madam Treasurer, your question is excellent, and there are multiple sources of funding that are going to support the expansion of broadband in rural areas for kids that need to connect for distance learning and online curriculum. I think, ironically, a lot of the locals are really right on the cutting edge of this. In Carroll County, they already had set up a program to try to provide expansion of their hotspots to connect to the libraries and the schools. Baltimore County is sort of ahead of the curve as well. On March 27th, we reached out because we thought we ought to sort of shift gears on the rural broadband rollout from the state's perspective to make sure that all of the students had connectivity available to them. So we reached out to the locals and found out that a lot of them were, in fact, ahead of the curve. And those that needed help, we provided. As you can see, this is fairly nominal, $87,000. But at the next BPW meeting, we will be presenting the entire capital budget request of $9.6 million to cover many of the counties and some of the local municipalities for pilot broadband connectivity as well as infrastructure connectivity. And we're working with the Maryland Broadband Cooperative very effectively. So at the next session, you'll see the effect of the entire appropriation for broadband connectivity. The other element, I think, to your question is the federal government and COVID support. There's $187 million going to local governments that's sort of coming through the state for a variety of educational purposes. And it's clearly articulated that the local municipal governments or the counties can use this to expand broadband connectivity. So, you know, they'll have a lot of expenses, but if they want, they can improve that sort of last mile hookup into the libraries and the schools. And so I think that the money is out there. It's a matter of good organization and planning. And I'm pleased to say that Rick Gordon in our department has been sort of really in the lead in thinking this thing through. And to some degree, he's followed Governor Hogan's in a lot of the municipal dialogue that we've had on a weekly basis. It's been clearly expressed that this is important, the municipalities. And so the governor made clear that this is something we ought to address.
Well, I think it's great that we are doing it. I just would hope that we would look at all the sources of funding when you do, because obviously, as the comptroller knows very well, and the governor, we're going to be in tough straits. I mean, there's not a lot of extra money. And if some of these funds are fungible and you can use some of the federal funds for this purpose and say the state funds to be used for things that only state funds can be used for, I would hope we would be looking at that.
We certainly are. Absolutely.
Can I ask another question of the secretary since we have him?
Number
two, and I have no issue with it. It's a settlement on down payments for individual homeowner loans. Are you all looking at what the economic effects of this pandemic and making any sort of projections on the impact of all the other things we have outstanding? Individuals.
We're preparing for renter assistance and foreclosure assistance. We want to make sure that people aren't evicted, and we want to make sure that homeowners aren't foreclosed on. So we have a program sort of ready in waiting to stand up. I think that we want to make sure that the relief that's on the table right now, the unemployment insurance, the $1,200 to each individual, the paycheck protection, all of these sources of sort of money into the hands of citizens are really designed to help pay the rent and pay the mortgages. And the forbearance, which is in the case of renters, really through about June 5th. It's basically a 90-day forbearance. With respect to mortgage forbearance, there's sort of two segments, 280-day segments that the federal government has outlined. And we have gotten anecdotal information back about renters from the Maryland Affordable Housing Coalition. We get a sense that maybe for the month of April, nearly 30% of the rent payments were sort of forbeared. So it's a pretty significant number through that cohort that are multifamily housing projects that we, the state, have financed. With respect to mortgages, we have some whole loans in our department, and I would say probably 8% of those have sought some kind of forbearance. So we are right on top of the issue. We're hoping that the relief that's provided will get folks through. If not, I think we have multiple solutions that we will bring to bear. There'll be probably some community development block grant money. Some of that's going to entitlement districts, like directly to the city of Baltimore and other jurisdictions, and they can use that for rent support. We will probably be getting a fairly significant amount of money through CDBG, and so we're planning for it. We're able to execute if and when the need arises. And I will say that we're working closely with the Maryland Affordable Housing Coalition, the housing advocates, as well as the court system to make sure that property owners and the tenants and everybody is working together. There's good messaging, good communication, so we don't have a huge rush of evictions, when you get into late June or July.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to know. I hope you'll keep us informed.
Thank you, Secretary.
Can I just interject, Madam Treasurer? I thought it was an excellent point, and Secretary Hull, thank you for your examination of this. And I know Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, you're heavily involved in all this too. But we granted a 90-day forbearance on paying taxes to businesses and families and individuals, and a lot of them said to me, kind of anecdotally, "Well, what happens if 90 days from now we owe X amount of taxes plus the additional estimated tax payments and other things that we may owe come July 15th. And my suggestion then is anybody that has difficulty at that point, we have very flexible payment plans that we can put people on that depending on what the economic situation is, there's enough flexibility there where there's communication, as you mentioned, Secretary Hull, that folks can be bridged over to whatever the new normal is. And so thank you for, trying to come up with a exit strategy from the 90-day forbearance that is not highly, disruptive as far as the normal routine under a normal economy. Thank you. Keep me in the loop also, as well as
we certainly will. And thank you for all your support.
Again, thank you, Mr. Secretary. I have just some questions for the Board of Elections on number 10, and it's not, my questions really are not necessarily on the settlement.
We do have Administrator Lamone able to join us by audio.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is Linda Lamone.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm sorry I don't have a camera on my ancient computer at this house, so you'll have to look at my blank screen and realize that I'm smiling. Yes, you will. good morning, everyone.
I'm asking about the special election and what lessons learned as we get ready for the primary.
I am humbled by the amount of work and success that the local boards of elections, in conjunction with the county government in the three counties in Congressional District 7, remarkable job under very difficult and compressed circumstances. And I'd also like to thank my staff and the governor's office for all the help they gave us, too. It was, think about it, we put together a brand new delivery of an election in 4 weeks. So lessons learned, we have some minor ones so far. I think we district showed that the retreat in California County is low, what it was.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up a little bit.
I said the delivery. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, just repeat what it was you just were saying.
All right. One of the things that we learned is that we probably need to work a little bit better with the post office. The mail delivery rate in Baltimore County was less than it was in Howard and Baltimore City. So we want to work better with them. And then I apologize for...
Excuse me. When you say the delivery rate, what precisely does that mean?
We analyze the delivery by the post office in each of the jurisdictions. And so, for example, based on the United States Post Office data, 95.30% of the ballots were delivered on or before April 27th. In Baltimore City, and it was almost 99%. Howard County, it was 95%. In Baltimore County, it was 90%. So we're concerned to find out what caused the delivery rate to be less in Baltimore County than it was in the other two, so that we can make sure that does not happen for the presidential primary election.
How does that?
Pardon?
I was going to say, is any of that related to? I was going to ask about bad addresses and if you knew anything about returns that came because of bad address. Now, anyone who's done kind of bulk mailing, you know, many of us that run for office and when you do a mail campaign, you typically get a number of addresses that come back where people have moved and not telling us. Do you know the numbers of those as well?
I'm going to ask my deputy, Nikki Charleston, if she'd jump in because she has the statistics on some of this mail issue. Nikki, are you there?
Thank you. This is Nikki Charleston with the State Board of Elections. So we have received just some preliminary information, as Linda presented, as to the ballots that were either delivered after Election Day or not at all. The counties are still receiving those ballots, and so if they did receive a new address from the post office, they did send out the ballot to that new address if there was time. In terms of collecting all of the reasons for undeliverable ballots, we don't have those yet. As I said, those counties are still counting ballots through the end of this week, and so we hope to be able to collect some of that. We do have some generic data from the post office about general government mailings, and so we'll be looking to see whether it lines up with that, but we just don't have that data yet.
Okay, I understand. Now, I do understand that at least what reported in the press that the ballots that are going out have the original date of the primary, and I understand it just was that these were all printed prior to the governor moving the primary date, and so it would have been, this is my term, not your term, difficult or a possible nightmare to try to change those ballots. So I guess there's instructions that have gone out to let people know that while it does have the original date, they have until June 2nd to get the ballots in the mail.
You have nailed it, Governor. It's exactly what happened. And we are initiating a huge PR campaign, and a large part of the message of that campaign is the date on the ballot. It would have been virtually impossible to have redone everything once the governor decided to separate the two elections. So,
could I just interrupt there, Madam Administrator, because I don't get that at all. I mean,
I'm sorry, I didn't get it.
Did the governor announce that the date was going to be changed?
March the 17th.
And what is the problem with getting immediately a new, at whatever cost was necessary, a new ballot with the proper date on the front of it?
Well, it's not just a matter of turning a switch off and correcting the date and turning it back on again. If you would like more details, Nikki is able to provide them. It's very complicated when you build an election.
What is the difficulty? I understand there's a cost, but it's kind of important, don't you think?
This is Nikki Charleston. It is important, and we spent a lot of time looking at whether that was possible to do. So as Linda said, the elections were split on March 17th. We had already started sending out ballots to our military and overseas voters. So those voters already had ballots in the mail or emailed to them to comply with federal law. And so send new ballots out to those military and overseas voters is a very deliberate process. And any time that you rush the programming of ballots and testing them and proofing them, you introduce risk. And so we decided that moving forward with a tested and proofed database and then educating voters that the April 28th date has no impact on a ballot being counted was the safest way to conduct this election under the circumstances.
That doesn't make any sense whatsoever, in my humble opinion. But, I mean, all you had to do was change the date on a system that had already been approved up in front instead of April 28th, put in June 2nd. or whatever it is, and it just, obviously there are costs involved there, but the idea that it was difficult and can't be done, couldn't have been done, or wasn't, shouldn't have been done, I mean, isn't this one of the main voter suppression tactics of people that we're always complaining about, that they have robocalls going into people's homes saying the election's already been held?
Well, I think this is very different.
Why's that?
We have...
getting something that suggests that the election's already been held.
We included with every ballot the instructions, a blurb explaining that this, it's right at the top of the instruction page, and it says that the reason why it says April 28th on it, that it does not affect any ballots being counted. And so we thought that, and then supplementing it through the voter outreach, that it would reach every voter with the information about why the ballot says the 28th of April, and that it wouldn't impact their ability to have their ballots for June 2nd.
Anyway, the damage has been done if it's out there, but I find it just, I'm incredulous that you didn't simply redo the ballot with the right date on it. And even at this point, I don't want to belabor the point, but I just think it's broadly unacceptable to send something out with that date on it and then expect people to figure out that, oh, this little blurb is somehow means that it's not April 28th and that I can still vote and not feel like a fool.
I do think it's going to require a lot of outreach, and that was, you know, the point even with the April 28th for the 7th district, that there's got to be a lot of clarification and outreach to let people know. And probably need to go on radio and television just to remind people that, you know, even though the ballot may say one thing, that they have until June 2nd to get that in the mail.
How much
is that? We are planning on doing this. We partnered with KJO Public Affairs, which is Rick Abruzzi as the lead, and Campfire Communications with Henry Falwell, Media, Mission Media, and Sandy Hillman Communications to do a outreach on the election, and part of the main message that they are going to be spreading is the date issue.
And they need to, you know, also state that if a person has not received a ballot, that they need to contact their local board of election. That's been my concern, that people change addresses, people move, people don't change addresses when they should, and they've already moved. And because there are people who move out of a particular district, but they go back to their old neighborhood to vote. And so they may not get that ballot because they don't live at the address that's in that precinct, but that's where they grew up or that's where they live for a long period of time. That's where their parents live, and they go back there vote, and they don't, and it may not reach them at their old place. So that's one of my concerns too.
And we plan to include that in the messaging. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Very briefly, members, I understand there is a disruption in the live stream caused by a power outage here in Annapolis. We will have the full recording of the meeting posted on the Board of Public website, Board of Public Works website, in short order. I also understand that we have President Wilson from Morgan State University available to rejoin us if he wanted to address the issue raised by Mr. Moran regarding the personal protective equipment provisions in the Downing Services contract.
Are we not streaming right now?
You are, Governor. I understand there's about approximately a minute gap.
That camera.
A while back due to the power outage at the Shaw House, but the live stream has been restored.
Okay. No wonder. I heard something that sounded like a slight boom, and the feed flickered. So I guess that was it. Okay. All right. Welcome back, Dr. Wilson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lieutenant Governor. I understand you can't hear me now?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Okay. First of all, good morning to all of you, and I certainly want to echo what I heard earlier in the meeting from Madam Secretary as well, from Mr. Comptroller regarding the role that the governor has played in the leadership in this crisis. I indicated that on yesterday we had our Board of Regents meeting here at Oregon, and the board was praiseworthy of the leadership of our governor, and certainly wanted to pass that along as well. We thank the state of Maryland for the investment.
Mr. President, I'm sure that the board also appreciated all the hard work and support of the General Assembly of Maryland in getting the appropriate funding, weren't they?
Yeah, so I was just about to go right there as well, Madam Secretary. And so the board was extremely appreciative of the support of the General Assembly in the resources that also have been made available to Morgan State University. At the close of the legislative session this year, we were getting the largest single appropriation in our history. We're very excited about that, and we want to continue down the path of the state's investment in the national treasure and in the institution that the state has designated as its preeminent public urban research university. I also want to say that with regard to the remarks made by the union president that Morgan State University will require, as we are requiring now, that all of our vendors on campus actually wear PPE. We even have secured an additional shipment of PPE, and so we have been operating in this mode since we went under executive order and had to designate many of our employees here at Morgan as essential employees. So in essence, no one shows up on the campus without appropriate PPE, and in the contract that we would actually enter into with the Dexel Magic, that would continue as well. And so let me stop there. I don't want to go on too long, but I certainly wanted to put forth those two messages. Thanks for the investments that are being made at this institution. We understand that with those investments, the state should expect a significant return, and that's what we are determined to do here at Morgan, is to give the state a significant return on the investment that it is making in Morgan. We do not see an investment in the same way as an expenditure. An investment is something where there's an understanding that there are dividends, and the dividends need to be, if you will, recognized, and that's what we are about. We will continue to open our doors to the students here at Morgan who are coming through these doors, particularly in the STEM fields, but in all fields, and they are populating the state to enable it to be much, much more competitive. We continue to lead the state, as I always say when I come before the Board of Public Works, in the production of black electrical engineers. We're number one. We're number one in civil engineering. We're number one in industrial engineering. We're number one in journalism. We're number one in social work. We're number one in all of these areas. And what COVID-19 has actually shown us amidst this incredible digital divide and the socioeconomic divide is that there's a tremendous opportunity here working with our School of Community Health and Policy and our School of Social Work to really raise their hands, and they are, to begin to respond to some of the public health challenges that we see via our nursing program and our public health programs. And so we see this as an incredible opportunity. The last thing I would say is that when we went to remote instruction on the campus, I decided that I did not want to not understand how our students were receiving instruction from Morgan. And so I decided that I was going to audit two online classes here at Morgan. So I audited a political science class, and I audited a class in music theory. I know absolutely nothing about music, even though I'm the number one jazz fan in the United States. and this was an experience for me. I tell you, it was an experience. And it enabled me to learn such a about both online education, just as a modality, and then the challenges of moving certain students in higher education to that modality so quickly, and expecting, if you will, that they will still get the high touch in addition to the high tech. And so we are now kind of moving back, taking the next 2 or 3 months to make sure that we are learning from what we have experienced, and we are putting in place now the planning process to perfect that modality should we find ourselves moving forward, embracing this form of instruction going forward, and we think we will have to in some capacity. And so finally, let me say, we heard the Board of Public Works 5 years ago. we heard you very, very clearly, and we were determined that we were going to put in place a procurement process for our RFP this year that could be an exemplar. And so I do want to thank Sydney Evans, our Vice President for Finance and Management, and the great team in procurement. I want to thank the legal assistance that we have received here at Morgan, and then the Office of the Attorney General to ensure, you know, that we were doing this process right and well. And so we thank you, actually, for giving us the comments last time around that you did, and we were the appreciate your comments. Saying to us that you think we did what you asked us to do. And so that's all that I have to say this morning. I'll be more than happy to respond to any questions that any of you might have.
Well,
thank you. Thank you for all you've done.
So thank you again, Dr. Wilson. It's always good to see you. I don't think I told the board that on my first trip to Israel back in January, Dr. Wilson attended a group of business people as well as the provost from UMBC, and he visited with a couple of the universities there. And
I did feel in the works, but very, very promising.
Yes, it was a wonderful trip. Also, I saw a report, Dr. Wilson, that Morgan is going to receive some money from the CARES Act. I think congressional delegation is working on that, and I saw it reported last night. And so, congratulations.
Yes, and so we are slated to get in total about $29 million from the CARES Act. We were initially projecting a $22.2 million deficit here at Morgan. And so these funds are coming at the right time. Of that $29 million, $4.6 million of that is going directly to students in the form of grants or stimulus checks, so to speak. And so the university has no power, based on the instructions that we received from the Department of Education, to restrict those dollars in any way. And so those dollars actually hit our account this morning, and we've already put in place the mechanism to determine which students at Morgan will actually get them, and they will see these dollars appear in their bank accounts, actually, within the next couple of days. The lowest check will be $250, and the maximum will be about $1,600. And so with the remaining, we have been asking the department for maximum flexibility, and so we are hoping that we can get the flexibility to enable us to, in a lot of ways, repay the university for all of the refunds that we've had to give the student housing costs and on the meal costs and on all the fees, which has been several million dollars.
Wow. Well, you know, a $250 check when I was an undergrad, a $25 check would have been wonderful. So
sometimes, Senator Governor, in my case, it was the 69-cent student special that we used to get right off campus. And so $5 has been great for me as well, you know.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Wilson. Okay. Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda? Move approval.
Second.
Okay.
a moment of personal privilege, Governor. If I could, I would just like to take a brief moment to recognize the work of Osvaldo Borges from the Department of Information Technology and deep gratitude on behalf of the board staff. OBI maintains the board's live stream under the traditional board meeting conditions, but has been doing fantastic work in this new environment to maintain public access to these proceedings, which I know is of paramount importance to the board. So I just wanted to take a brief moment to recognize Osvaldo and just offer my personal thanks.
Excellent.
And all of ours. Did we lose the governor?
Okay, there. I got dropped. I didn't do anything this time. It came back and said the organizer had dropped me from the...
Better watch it.
Nothing personal.
Our own state employees, they just don't like me, so what can I say? Okay, Department of Natural Resources.
Governor, could I just say I'm 2A2. Church Lane Site Park in Pikesville, that Senator Edelman, it takes a little while to call her Senator Edelman instead of Delegate Edelman, asked me to thank the Secretary for the hard work and rejoice with her constituents in Pikesville in this great project. So, thank you, Madam Secretary.
Thank you very much, and good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Jeannie Hadaway Riccio, Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. We have 6 items on our real property agenda today, including the item that Madam Treasurer just mentioned, and item 3A is being withdrawn. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Madam Treasurer, you mentioned Senator Edelman. When I was in Israel, met her sister-in-law, I believe, works for the embassy there, so U.S. embassy. So I also have an opportunity to meet her sister-in-law. I don't have any questions on Department of Natural Resources. I just wish I could get back out to the parks with the Secretary, but maybe we will pretty soon.
Thank you, sir. We're looking forward to that.
And Madam Secretary, you're going to come back with an explanation or educational session for us on 3A?
Yes.
We'll definitely have more information and hope to have it on the agenda in the very near future. I think it's a really positive step and a really good move forward for the long-term sustainability of our land preservation projects and programs.
So it's worth some time in educating us, and I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We're happy to do it.
Thanks. Very good. Do we have a motion on the Secretary's agenda?
Move approval.
All right. I think we're all in favor. Thank you, Madam Secretary. University system. There's Joe.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 4 items on the agenda. Here to answer any questions.
I have a question on 3, the option. This is the dental clinic contract.
Yes, sir.
Is this a standard practice that dental schools around the country that you set up a separate nonprofit that provides, I guess, its oversight and some dental services, oversight of the dental students, but I guess also there's some dental services that the faculty provides along with the dental students?
I have Valerie Sakura, who's on the line from, and she is the assistant dean for administration and finance at the School of Dentistry.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor and Madam Treasurer and Mr. Comptroller. This is Valerie Sakura. In regards to your question about the standard practice of a nonprofit, it actually is not. It's many schools across the country have state employees or unionized employees working in these clinics versus having a separate nonprofit operation. We are one of the few dental schools that have a separate nonprofit entity to run the clinical operations as part of this. The benefit we see is that having this structure allows us the flexibility as it relates to personnel matters. And I think one thing that is very important to note is that the revenues from these clinics are transferred to the dental school state budget for the benefit of student clinics. And these clinical activities are very instrumental to our students' clinical education and our service to the community.
But the individuals who are operating the clinic are university employees, correct?
They are faculty that operate the clinic, but the educational mission is directed by the dean and the School of Dentistry.
And
dental assistants, and my apologies for interrupting, the dental assistants and nurses and those employees are not state employees. They are employees of this nonprofit.
Oh, okay. Now, the state employees, the faculty that are working there, are they receiving separate income, or is this just part of their teaching responsibilities?
They are, if the clinical practice, the faculty clinical practice only, not the student clinics, they do not receive any compensation for the student clinics above their faculty compensation as part of their role in the School of Dentistry, but as faculty clinics for any urgent care that is not urgent, but any of their what is considered extreme cases of in the community that is referred to the dental practice and faculty see those patients, they are eligible to receive supplemental income if there are revenues generated from those services.
Who are these services open to? They open to the, you say community, is it the university community or is it the general public as well?
General public, all, we draw patients from the entire state and even outside of the state, we draw patients into the clinic.
So I guess those who may not have dental benefits or you know, as well as students are able to utilize this clinic.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, have you evaluated the cost of running the clinic this way through the nonprofit versus what it would be if you did it through some other commercial operation or with state employees?
It is frequently evaluated. I think the last time that we did a formal evaluation with the Board of Regents, it was in 2014, but as part of our annual budget review process, we reviewed this, as a matter of fact, just yesterday with the president of UMD. So it is assessed. I think the mission to provide the highest quality care at the most affordable prices has allowed, by having a nonprofit structure, has allowed us to keep those costs down in a way that I think a for-profit would not have the same motivation in terms of generating revenue.
Right. Any questions?
Move approval if not.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Dean and Joe. So do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. Thank you, University System.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, Department of Transportation. There he is, Secretary.
Oops.
Don't please unmute your microphone, Mr. Secretary.
There we go. Good morning. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Good morning. Great to see everyone this morning. It was great to see Dr. Wilson from Morgan on. If you're not aware, they have a great transportation urban institute. They have a civil engineering program. They have a national transportation institute. And they do an amazing summer transportation institute for local kids. And they contribute a lot to our workforce, and we work very closely with them. So one of the premier programs in the region. So, good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Greg Slater, Secretary, Maryland Department of Transportation. The Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 10 items for your consideration. Items 1-AE is being withdrawn, leaving 9 for your consideration. And I am here as well as representative to answer any questions you may have.
I don't have any questions. I like the fact that in 5AE, you went through the Small Business Reserve Program for engineering services, and just appreciate that effort.
Absolutely.
Any questions on transportation's agenda?
Well, I had a question on number 1, but you preempted it.
Absolutely. We're still very committed to that project. It's we're working with Southwest and how we issue the revenue bonds, and when that market comes back, we'll kind of work very closely with them. But we're still very committed to matching their pace when it comes to air service returning.
When you do come back, and maybe before that, I had a question with regard to why you would need a construction management inspection service when you have construction management at risk. So maybe there's some information you can get to me on that.
Absolutely. I can work with you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions on transportation agenda?
Move approval, if not.
I don't have a question, but I'd point out, I think, in 10C, it's from the State Highway Administration. I have no concern about the contract. It looks good, but traditionally, and I'm not sure about legally, that you had to bring that to the Board of Public Works, and I very much appreciate your doing it.
Yes,
ma'am. When, you know, we traditionally bring facilities, but not roadway projects, and so we always kind of go back and err on the side of caution when there are both involved so that we bring it all in one, just to be sure.
Thank you.
Please feel free to bring all the road projects, and you can tell MBTA that they can bring their bridge and tunnel projects as well. We'd love to have all of those. I won't get started on that. I did get started, but I'm just being nice about it. All right. So do we have a second on the? Okay. We're all in favor. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, BJ.
Okay, you too. Department of General Services. There's Nelson.
Oops.
Gentlemen, your microphone.
There we go. Okay now?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Nelson Reichert, Deputy Secretary of the Department of General Services. Today we are presenting 34 items, including one supplemental for your consideration.
I hate to interrupt you. Is there a way you could adjust your microphone? We're getting some feedback.
Let's see.
Is your phone nearby? I mean, I don't know if that's
going to... No, phone's off. Is that better?
No.
No, sir.
Does that help any?
Nope.
No, I think we may have to just get through this, or...
I
have nothing
that would have affected.
It's radioactive. It does sound like a Geiger counter or something.
Yeah.
Do they still have those things?
That is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Radiation detector.
Yeah.
Do they still have a little bit of a glow there?
I'm terribly sorry. I don't know. I don't know what would be causing it to create.
All right. Well, I guess we can just suffer through it.
Okay. We have representatives available to answer any questions if you at this time.
Well, Nelson, it was my understanding that you were going to give us an update about the emergency procurements now. Is that right? You and whomever else you needed to support you.
And the state's chief procurement officer, Robert Gleason, is available. Can be brought in to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Well, I think everybody should hear what the process is for doing the emergency procurements, first of all. And then I know my understanding is that we're going to see the first ones at the next meeting. But what the process is and how we go about making sure that they're good procurements, I know both the comptroller's office warrants the expenditures when they come from the agency, and then the treasurer's office actually processes and gets them the checks written or the wires sent. So we're all involved in this, and I think it should just be made clear what the process, what your part of the process is.
Okay. Robert Gleason is available to get through the process.
Somewhere without the guidance.
Nelson,
can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Good morning. This is Bob Gleason, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. This is Bob Gleason, for the record, Chief Procurement Officer. I'm here to address any questions you have with regard to the emergency procurement activities over the last 4 weeks. Certainly it's an experience that's worth telling. I think it will probably take more time than we have at the moment, or at least in the detail that we would like to do that. But I can tell you it's most unusual circumstances. And let me pause for a minute and see if you have a specific question around process, because there is an emergency process that we do follow.
I would like to know what the process is that you're using to be... Okay. I mean, there are billions of dollars involved, and everyone should understand what the process is.
Certainly. So, based upon the emergency declaration, we commenced to work with the Department of Health and the Maryland Emergency Management Agency to understand what the requirements were to meet the needs for health, life, and safety around the COVID event. There is an emergency procurement method which we follow, and the fact that the Maryland Emergency Agency is the lead agency in terms of understanding how to meet the exigencies of the emergency, all requirements go through the Web EOC, which is an incident management reporting system that is nationwide under the FEMA program. So all requirements in terms of capacity building, beds, field medical sites, ICU, modular trailers, equipment, all of that must go through the WebEOC. Once it goes through the WebEOC,
what is the WebEOC?
The WebEOC is a National Emergency Management Incident Reporting System. So anything that is required in any state or jurisdictional emergency must go through there for federal reporting requirements. And I will confess I'm not a web EOC emergency management expert by any stretch, but we do operate what I would refer to as the EMS-7, Emergency Management Services 7, which is logistics and acquisition. So
this,
to the extent...
Let me just say, this is all managed by Maryland's Emergency Management
Agency. Correct.
So it comes through MEMA, and DGS is Emergency Operation 7, as a seat at the table out at the MEMA headquarters in Reisterstown.
Yes, okay. Governor. Once it comes to us, then we have to source and procure that requirement. If we have a contract in place, then we order off the existing contract. To the extent that we don't have a contract in place, then we have to source a supplier or a service to provide a service. And I can tell you after the last month and a half, 2 months, it's been a struggle with many of the materials, and it becomes a supply and demand issue. So once we get the requirement to source and contract that, we go through the emergency procurement process, and we develop a contract or purchase orders with the suppliers either that we have or that we must develop as a part of the emergency. And I can tell you over the past 2 months, we've had over 109 orders, contracts, and approximately $314 million based on a report, the most recent report I have that was submitted on EMMA, Maryland Marketplace Advantage, which covered the period March 23rd to April 26th. Much of that has to do with standing up the field medical site in Baltimore, the convention center, 250-bed medical site that's handled by both UMS and the Hopkins system. We've also procured modular ICU units that are going at Fort Washington and Prince George's County regional hospitals. All of this is predicated on the medical models that were going to be needed for the COVID emergency in terms of the capacity, either with the... over 6,000 COVID-positive patients, which might exceed the capacity of the hospital system. We were required to stand up the field medical site there at the convention center for Washington, Prince George's County, regional. And we also have acquired some additional capacity in terms of tents. These are 10-person ICU critical COVID patient tents that are being used as supplementary sites at hospitals around the state. A certain number of tents were allocated to Department of Corrections, Public Safety, for use at Hagerstown and Jessup. So the process is to develop contracts to provide for those services and those materials, the equipment and supplies to do all that. A lot of it has focused on healthcare, which necessitates a need for ventilators, in this case for patients that are under stress and require clinical care at that level. Of course, a lot of these things are not things that we normally buy. Typically, we buy tires, tubes, vehicles, most of the stuff that you can run any jurisdiction. So a lot of these things are medical related, as well as personal protection equipment, PPE. PPE is sort of the general term around masks. Call it the 3 Gs, gloves, gowns, and goggles. But particularly for the clinicians in what we call hot zones, and I've learned a lot of terminology over the last couple of months, but the gowns have to be impermeable going into what they call a hot zone. And so there's only a limited amount of supply, and this isn't a crisis that certainly we're all aware that it is international, global, and there's only so many masks, so many gloves, so many goggles that are available. So we look at local fabrication with local companies here. So, sorry, I could go long on this, so but let me just go back to your process question. Most of the suppliers are vetted to make sure that they have a Dun & Bradstreet, that they are registered to do business in the state of Maryland. And in terms of supply and demand, to the extent that there's not sufficient supply, then sometimes we have to use brokers, and we have to go in private sector speak, tier two, tier three type of sources. And I know that some of my other states, my peers, we're all struggling. I'm on a weekly call every Monday. And all 50 states and all cities, towns, counties, first responders, all clamoring for the same goggles, gowns, and gloves. There's not enough capacity. And a new term I've learned is called burn rate. And to the extent that people have to use them once, unless they are washable, that consumes a lot. There's figures that are generally available through the emergency process that is reported every day. Talks about it doesn't matter how many millions of gloves or millions of gowns we buy, we burn them up. They have to consume them in all the hospital environments within a matter of days or weeks. So demand far exceeds supply. So it's been a struggle. We don't have enough, and we are working to do that. I would also point out that once we get a supplier vetted through Commerce, then we use them through EMMA. We have an RFI, a request for information process, in EMMA. And again, they have to register, provide all the information and all the due diligence there, and then we're able to work with them. I'll stop there and pause because this could go very long, but see what other questions you have about process. The other thing I would add real quick, we developed a process several weeks ago for a Maryland First type of initiative. So to the extent that we can't fill orders for PPE and other things through the standard sources such as Grainger and many of the contractors we typically historically rely on, then we look to our local suppliers to try to fabricate, manufacture that sort of thing.
Okay, I don't want to cut you short, but
no, please.
I appreciate it. Clearly, I think what would be best is if you don't mind, if you talk to our staff over the next 2 weeks and came back with a report or description, you or Nelson or whomever, Governor, on what the process is that Maryland uses to decide what's needed, to select the vendors, and to expend the funds. I know we're going to have a number of items on the agenda next time, and I've been hoping that we understand the process now so we didn't have to do that in 2 weeks. But I think it sounds like it would be better to give you all a chance to actually prepare a clear presentation of the information that we have to know before we approve of these items. That is, how you knew you needed them. You, meaning not only you, Bob, but the agencies of government who are presenting the items to us, actually, MDOT, MNIT, Corrections, et cetera, and get back to us. I don't want to use up your valuable time.
If I could just add one more thing very quickly, just for a second here. One of the struggles that we've had is the competition that we are in with many of our sister states on the calls that I face. I mentioned supply being very little. Many of the other states that I've worked with have gone far upstream into the supply chain, going so far as to go to China and actually buy their way into the production chain, only to find a day later that their order was canceled by the factory, so that the other countries, basically from the Indian subcontinent, would buy 6 months' worth of supply that was sorely needed here in the U.S. So there's a lot of things going on in the marketplace that I know that some jurisdictions are paying 100% up front in sort of an expeditionary payment in order to guarantee an assurance that the supplies would be available for them. Our system is not geared for that type of payment or financial wherewithal. So in many cases, we've lost deals to some of my peers. I also know that when we've learned a lot about Incoterms, things that typically procurement's not faced with in terms of international import-export. And I've had some of my colleagues had their shipments paid for with cash out from under them at the ports where the goods have been disembarked. So there's a lot going on here, and I'd be very happy to speak with your staff. Thank you.
If I could just add in, Lieutenant Governor and others, I really appreciate the Treasurer bringing this subject up. And I'm fundamentally interested in how many contracts we've entered into, what is the state lost, if any, based on the concerns that Mr. Gleason just suggested because of the volatility of the marketplace. What have we paid out? What was the per unit, you know, price that we paid? Basically, how much money there is that has been spent, understandably, to get these supplies, and where we are as far as the dollars out, product in, just the names of the companies, how the state got presented these contracts. I've had numerous calls from people that magic old acquaintances of mine who happened to have a new relationship with someone in China. Well, really? So that's kind of, if you could sort out what exactly entered into, what monies you paid out, what's at risk, who introduced you to these folks, how exactly the contracts are being vetted, and I assume they're being vetted very closely. I'm not suggesting anything contrary. But I think just the most amount of transparency we can get would be appreciated.
Mr. Comptroller, thank you very much, and I will look forward to speaking with the staff. I will say that in being very transparent, I put my cell phone, my email, and all my other phones out on the web, on the website, and I think every supplier in the country has found me, and I've become one of the lightning-rod targets here.
That probably was not good, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, I did it on other times. These are different times that we're operating in.
Yeah, and Mr. Comptroller, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've been contacted by elementary school friends, high school friends, people I've gone to school in college with. I received an email on my Maryland official email from some joker in China that I've never heard of, didn't know who he was, and said, I live in China, I can help you with blah, blah, blah. So generally what we've been doing is NEMA and General Services have set up a website that they collect information from vendors, and I just send that to my friends and anyone else, except for the guy in China, that send your information to them, send them their specs, and let them handle it. Who can get a special deal, it seems like.
Governor, if I could just say one more thing. I'd just like to say thanks to the procurement officers out there. They've been on the front lines for over 50 days, 7 days a week, oftentimes 10-hour days. Every day's Monday for these procurement officers, and they've only been established as a unit in only the last 6 months, 8 months when they started. And I would say that a lot of the processes are new. They did not have the technology until recently to be able to operate, and in fact, the financial technology has been a bit of a burden in terms of being able to get the necessary processes in place. And I would like to thank the staff of the Comptroller and the Treasurer for all the assistance that their staff has helped throughout this process as well, because I know they're doing a lot of extraordinary work too. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Bob, thank you for recognizing our procurement officials who are doing a great job. I just was given an article that I guess it was in Yahoo News where our own Danny Mays was interviewed there, and this was back in April 10th, and he talks about a number of the challenges that you just mentioned with regard to doing business with some of these international providers and the challenges that they're facing in competition with other states. So
I think one of the things I've said to them is they have to be responsive, reasonable, and rational in every situation that they're in. And I think they've stepped up to the plate, and they've done enormous duty in the last 50-plus days.
I would hope it would all be documented as well. Because
well, yes, ma'am, and we've documented things. I think in some cases where it takes time to go through what we would consider routine processes, I found out that the next jurisdiction over has made the deal before we could get to it. So we've lost many deals that we were not able to make in a timely way, but yes, ma'am, we have documented all the processes that we could.
I don't know if it makes you feel any better, Bob, but I'm on a call with state treasurers twice a week, and they all have the same story and the same concerns. But it is important that we follow procedures that everyone understands and that these things are documented so that when we go back after the fact.
Yes, ma'am.
Great. Thank you.
I'm aware that after 2001, 2003 was a banner year for auditors, lawyers, and many others. So I'm very cognizant that when this is done, I will be reviewed, scrutinized, and checked out.
The other thing is to have an understanding, not just of what your role is or what DGS is, but how it fits in with the other agencies, health or corrections, who know what they need, and then finally what the role of the Board of Public Works is as well.
Yes, ma'am. I agree.
Thanks.
Madam Treasurer, we will get together with your staff and go through the process procedures.
And the controllers and the governors.
And the controllers, yes. Go through the procedures for procurements and emergency procurements. If I may, because of whatever was involved in the system here, didn't finish. We are withdrawing items 14S, 12S, MOD, 33IT, MOD, and 34S. But we'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
I want to ask about a modification on 19IT MOD. It appears that this, the various increases in this contract have tripled through the length of the contract. And there's reference to a task order RFP being developed for a new project management office. I'm a little concerned, one, that we reached this point that we're tripling the cost of this project, but also then, I have some real concerns about the timing associated with this task order RFP. Could someone talk about this item?
Certainly. Dana Dembrough, the Director of Procurement for Maryland Department of Health, and Herb Jordan, their Chief EIO Officer, are available to answer your questions.
Thank you, Nelson. Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Controller, good morning. For the record, this is Dana Dembrough. I'm the Director of the Office of Procurement and Support Services for the Maryland Department of Health. This item, number 19IT, is a one-year extension of the Cognosante contract, now known as MTT, It's a $9 million request with eligibility for 90% federal reimbursement for the contract to provide project management support for implementation of the new MMIS, the Medicaid Management Information System, which is the platform that Maryland relies upon to fulfill all of our Medicaid responsibilities, including reimbursement from the feds annually and the nature of billions of dollars. We're in the midst of a massive transformation of MMIS through a dozen separate procurements, as you know, as we modularize this new system, and it's going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of the next several years. In the meantime, we have this project management support. We have a team of IT experts from the department prepared to respond to the Lieutenant Governor's questions or any other questions. And if you wish to pose a question, I'll then turn the mic over to the Chief Information Officer, Herb Jordan, who can introduce the team available to respond.
Okay. My specific question deals with in the material, it states that the department is developing a new, or has developed a new, task order request for proposal, and expected to be there to be award in December. To me, that seems to be a long time for a task order, because the idea of a task order is that it's a task under an existing contract where you've already had competition. I don't understand why it takes over 7 months to issue a contract under a task order. Maybe Herb can explain some of that.
Yes,
part of this is looking at process improvement. That's why I'm really concerned. If this is a challenge, it shouldn't be the case.
Thank you, Rob. This is Herb Jordan, Enterprise Chief Information Officer for the Maryland Department of Health. Madam Treasurer, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, in response to your question, I have been first introduced my panel. I have a group of people here that can help me answer these questions, just so you know who they are. I have present with me today Fiala Tony, who is the Director of Medicaid Systems Development. She is in charge of this new program, this Medicaid Enterprise Systems Transformation Project. I've got John Mulner. He's the Director of Portfolio Management, who has put in place a lot of changes to ensure this project, which is a much larger, different project than its predecessor, works and addresses many of the concerns from that prior project. And I've got John Bonds, who's also works as the Director of Procurement and Finance for the Office of Enterprise Technology as well. So those folks are all there. So getting back to your specific question, as I say, it's a privilege to be in front of you guys. For so many years, I've sat with Federal Secretary Reed on the other side of the microphone. A little different on this side. However, I'm here because Dennis Schrader couldn't be here. As you know, we're in the middle of a major healthcare crisis, and Dennis Schrader, who is the Medicaid director and also the chief operating officer for the Maryland Department of Health, who's my boss, has been detailed for the COVID surge response. And so, in his absence, I will address your questions. So getting back to the task order and how, why it's taking so long. First of all, it's a very, very large task order, and very complicated in the sense that this is the foundation for the success of this MIS transformation. Is it going forward, this modular project? This is the foundation. This is the most important procurement in terms of providing the foundation for the leadership and the resources that we need to make this project successful. And getting into the details of what that looks like in terms of we've gone through a process with this procurement, basically leveraging an existing master contract CATS to create this task order. It's taken a while for a lot of different reasons. John Mulner has been involved in the details of this and Meridian, so I'll have John Mulner speak to specifically why it's going to take as long as it is, given that's a task order contract.
No, and just very succinctly, and thanks for the time, and thanks, Herb. But really, the task order is under the CATS contract, and I'm sure you're familiar with the CATS contract, Governor. The point of it is it has over 7,000 vendors on that contract. So whether it's negotiated or not, it certainly isn't negotiated at the level of detail that this task order is written. I think the task order itself is over 200 pages. So there are certainly specifics and details on this that have to be quoted within the response period But again, we're dealing with 7,000 vendors. It basically is a typical procurement process that we're going through. And certainly the response to that task order request has been a very competitive environment that we're going through. I'm not going to give you the number, but I can just tell you that it's very competitive at this point, and we are dealing with quite a bit of an evaluation process.
And Governor, let me also add that the number of firms, that 7,000 that qualified for this procurement, is 586.
Well, I think what we'll do, I'm not going to tie up everyone's time here, but I think I'm going to look at that and ask our Office of Performance Improvement to look at the process associated with these task orders, because I know it's complicated, but, you know, I know on the federal side, and I think Herb is familiar with what happens on the federal side, I'm not sure it takes quite as long for a agency to acquire program management or any other things using the GSA Schedule 70 or the GWACs, or government-wide contract vehicles, that there are ways to streamline. And if our task order RFP is 200 pages, that sounds way, way too high. There's too many provisions in there. But I'm not the one looking at that. I'd like to look at this process a little more carefully and make sure we're protecting ourselves and we're getting the best value for what we're acquiring. But I just, the whole point of having task orders is that you've already had that pre-competition and you're coming back and negotiating price and services, and you are supposed to be able to move this a little quicker. So, but that is something we'll talk about as lessons learned as we work to try to improve our processes as we move forward.
And Governor, how are you?
We're answering the questions.
Governor, I was also going to add, any way we can help you with that, we're all in. Obviously, NASPA, IT-70 are ways to shorten the cycle. As you imagine, the series of procurements required for this, the critical path for all this is 11 off procurement cycles. So if we can shorten that, it does great things for the health department in terms of getting this thing done.
Okay. Yeah, we've started the process looking at how that review process takes place, because I think that's a little cumbersome. There are too many hands that it's passing through. And in some cases, the same hands twice. And that doesn't really make sense. And it doesn't. We don't need the assistant attorney general in different departments to look at it, so that you have two lawyers looking at it at separate stages when it should be just one. And they need to figure out that as well. So it's just too many hands, too many cooks in the in the kitchen who really have nothing to do with it. And there's a process problem that is tying this up. So we'll take a closer look at this as well as other task order items.
Okay. Thank you.
Lieutenant Governor, could I get the Deputy Secretary or former Delegate Dembro or somebody just to slowly repeat what items were withdrawn?
Certainly, Mr. Comptroller. We were withdrawing items 11, 12S mod, 16S mod, 33IT, and 34S. So 11, 16, 33, and 34 are withdrawn.
Okay. I thought you said item 14 when you were first saying that.
I did. It was a mistake on my part. I'm sorry.
Governor, just ask, what is the story with this situation here, and are we in contact with this one individual's family and the individual, him or herself? And it seems to be a tremendous amount of money we're spending on a Virginia institution which has been under investigation for all sorts of scandalous activities, and I just hope we're on top of this.
Is Greg James? Do you have Greg James?
Greg James is available to address this issue.
Good morning. This is Greg James from Hooker, Deputy Secretary for the Maryland Department of Human Services. I have a meeting online to Neil Thomas, who is our Chief of Staff for the Social Services Administration, as well as Antoinette White, who is one of our contract administrators, who is involved in the monitoring of this program. from the contract side of the shop, the actual oversight of the child and making sure the child is receiving the services that are needed is also performed by the caseworker for this child. So we currently have one youth based at Cumberland Hospital in New Kent, Virginia. This youth has a very complex and it is our understanding that there is no program, no hospital or child-serving program in the state of Maryland that has the capacity to meet both those medical needs and the behavioral health needs. So that is why the child was placed in Cumberland Hospital. We are in frequent contact. So we have had monitoring visits with this child or with this program. We had a monitoring visit at the start of December. We then had an unannounced site visit based upon the information that we received about the incidents that had occurred there. That occurred February 13th and 14th. As a result of the out-of-state travel restrictions, we have performed a video conference inspection on April 7th, and we have another video conference scheduled in May with this program. In addition, we have had our caseworker has had frequent contact with this child, and we had two teleconferences in April. We will be in contact. We had another teleconference just at the start of this week and have another one scheduled in approximately a week from now. So we are in constant contact with our child there, ensuring that they are safe. The incident at Cumberland Hospital involved a doctor who was on staff there and allegations of improper sexual conduct with children at that program. Thankfully, based on our interviews there and our discussions directly with the child is very verbal and able to speak for themselves. Our child was not one of the children involved in that conduct. So it is our understanding that, Cumberland Hospital, that individual obviously has been removed from duty and separated from that program, that there has been an intense investigation by their regulatory agency in Virginia, and that they have taken corrective action there to address the situation. So based upon this, we do believe that this continues to be the best and appropriate placement for this youth at this time.
Okay, thank you. You've been in touch with the leadership of the hospital or facility?
Absolutely.
Okay. But, you know, the concerns there. But thank you very much for that, Governor, for letting me ask. I have one other item I'd just like to highlight, if I could,
yeah.
Very quickly. You know, of the Board of Public Works is voting on contracts, which I think is important because we want to keep the business of the state functioning properly, and I particularly want to thank the governor or legislature, someone for the capital grant to Roundhouse Theater, which is in the neighborhood of the Treasurer in Bethesda. This Roundhouse Theater, in my opinion, is a cultural gem for our region. We're getting $500,000 in capital improvement grants or matching money. And it's just one example among many of nonprofit organizations that have been hard hit by the coronavirus issue, but are going to come back stronger. And I appreciate the support of the administration for moving Roundhouse Theater forward. It's the type of thing that I guess could be put at the end of the line and not considered for a while, but it's important that we keep moving these dollars out where appropriate and justified.
Thank you.
And I'm going to just mention that I was just on a call yesterday with one of the groups we're talking to, along with the 13 industry groups that Commerce is talking to, and our Office of Community Initiatives has two separate groups. One is the faith community, and the other is the nonprofit community. And I was on a call with the nonprofits yesterday where the conversation is requesting from these different groups, the nonprofits, the industry groups, the faith groups, how they can reopen safely, trying to get their input, their best practices to tell us, you know, in terms of government, how can they come back to operation and how they can work to make sure people are as safe as possible as they do. So we're trying to, you know, reach out to all that are involved and make sure that, you know, our nonprofit community comes back as well as the commercial side as well.
Excellent. Thank you. I would move approval unless you have a question.
Any question, Madam Treasurer, on the general services?
I would echo what the Comptroller said, of course, about Rothhaus, but also point out that so many of our community organizations, most particularly thinking of the arts community right now, are doing a terrific job of reaching out to the community via these instruments that we're all using now, both with performances and with classes. It's just terrific, and I trust it will be one of the lessons learned and continue when we're all back together again. Yeah, great institution roundup.
Very good.
Thank you.
Our theater is wonderful. So, okay, I think we have a motion from the comptroller. All right, so we're all in favor. Thank you, Deputy Secretary Reichert, and thank you all. I think that is the end of our agenda. Thank you very much.
Thank you. See you in 2 weeks.
Thank you, board members. Thank you.
Now we never.